You know, that's the biggest hole in this podcast now, is that Matt was the one who could pronounce his last name.
Oh, yes.
former Clemson quarterback DJ. I'm not even going to attempt it, but we'll have to edit in.
We're on first name terms now.
We'll have to edit in audio of Matt saying his name. Welcome to Three Idiots and a Lawyer. Joe Schell here along with Kevin O'Keefe. And Kevin, it's been a couple weeks since we last spoke. There's been a lot going on with Syracuse sports. The basketball team's played a handful of games. Looking at what's right in front of us here today, the ACC released the football schedule. So now we know who and when Syracuse will be playing next year in football. A few things stand out here, but first let's just kind of run down what we're looking at here. Syracuse is going to open against Ohio on August 31st. And then they'll jump right into ACC play on September 7th with a home matchup against Georgia Tech. Then they'll have a home matchup against ACC newcomer Stanford after the bye. After that, we'll have an FCS game against Holy Cross in the Dome. Then Syracuse takes a trip to Las Vegas to play the UNLV Runnin' Rebels. That should be an interesting matchup. We'll come back to that. October 12th, a road game against NC State. Followed by the next week, actually, is there another bye in there? It looks like there's another bye in there.
And then we play Pitt, yeah.
And a Thursday night matchup against Pitt in Pittsburgh. November 2nd, we have Virginia Tech in the Dome. November 9th, Boston College in Boston. November 16th, we go out west again to play Cal for the first matchup of ACC play with them. Then we come back to the Dome to play UConn. And we round out the year in the Dome against Miami. So a couple things jump out here at me, but Kevin, let's start with you. What kind of stands out to you with the football schedule here?
Yeah, I mean, we were just talking about how this schedule is very obviously lacking Clemson, Florida State, Notre Dame. We're not playing any of the above for the first time that we've been in conference, to my recollection. I think we've played at least Clemson and Florida State every year since 2014. I don't know about Notre Dame. I know we've played them a handful of times.
Just a handful. Most of those aren't those aren't really conference games. The only time that was a conference, that was 2020.
I feel like we've drawn them several times.
We had a series scheduled with them, so we'd play them.
I guess a better way to put it is Clemson, Florida State, or some juggernaut that we're clearly going to lose to.
Yeah, there's not really a mark on the calendar that looks like.
Stanford game might be interesting, but I don't see any clear, like, we're going to get blown out by two touchdowns or more.
Nothing
on this
stands
schedule.
Out as a blowout.
I mean, we have, is it seven home games, which is really nice. I know we had six and then the one neutral site game this year. But all in all, I mean, the two byes is kind of throwing me off. And, you know, we were just also mentioning how there are two byes, but now the ACC also no longer has divisions. So I guess that started this year. It's just a very different way of doing things. We're adding, you know, all these weird teams like SMU and Stanford. So I guess that just means the top two teams in the conference will meet in the conference championship game.
Right. What happened this year.
Right. It's just a new way of doing things, and thinking about being in the conference championship game is just not something I've done in ever.
Yeah, I think we're one of the biggest benefactors of that in a time where we're clearly, you know, really trying to compete. It seems the school's going full throttle trying to compete in football. And now, like you said, you don't have to play Clemson and Florida State every year. And that was really the biggest drag on our schedule for the most part, was you were guaranteed to play both of them every single year. Mm-hmm. And now that we're facing some of those other the Coastal Division was always the easier road to the ACC championship game. So now you just got to have one of the top two conference records. And I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but I think we could talk ourselves into being in a position like that over the course of the next few years with the players that Fran Brown is bringing in.
Yeah. I like that we're starting off with, you know, kind of a tune-up game against Ohio.
It should be. So on paper, Ohio is an interesting looking team. They were 10-3 last year. They finished their season by beating Georgia Southern 41-21 in the Myrtle Beach Bowl. But what jumps out to me is Ohio had the 130th strongest schedule in FBS last year out of 131 teams. So Ohio had a decent record, but they didn't play anybody really.
Mm-hmm.
What I don't like, and this is no one's fault, but it really hurts losing that Army game. Army was supposed to be one of our road games this year. That was going to be an in-state road game, which how often do we travel in-state to play a football game? Usually those games are in the dome, but now instead of traveling to West Point to play Army, which I think would be a pretty favorable matchup for us, despite how we performed this year in the first half against them. Now we have to travel to the West Coast to play UNLV in Las Vegas. And I think it's in the Raiders' new stadium. I think UNLV plays their home game.
Mm-hmm.
To have to make that road trip, and that's when we already have to travel to play Cal later in the year. So now Syracuse has two West Coast trips. When we haven't played on the West Coast since 2011, when we played USC, now we have two trips to the West Coast, which is a challenge. And that's college football now. These conferences are not, they're not geographically based, and it's going to be a challenge for some schools.
Well, the schools aren't geographically based, but the conference is still called the ACC.
Right.
Which, I mean, I guess that all got thrown out the window when there was a time when the Big 12 had 10 teams and the Big 10 had 12 teams. I always found that hilarious.
Right. This is extreme, though. I mean, these really conferences don't have any geographical sense to them. But besides the travel, I just feel like trading that Army game to play UNLV. UNLV is a big question mark to me, but they did go 9-5 last year. They lost to Boise State in the Mountain West Championship. So they played for a conference championship, and they ended up losing to Kansas, who was ranked 23rd last year, 49-36 in the Guaranteed Rate Bowl. Initial thoughts, at least to me, are that it's not a gimme game by any means. It could be a challenging game, and to have to travel like that to play that. I would love to see them start off the year strong, but that's a toss-up for me right now. We'll have to see how the team looks in the fall, but certainly overall, you come away with the sense that this schedule on paper isn't as challenging as the ones we've seen the last few years, and some of those schedules weren't all that challenging themselves. So I feel like a revamped, retooled Syracuse roster is really getting a schedule that puts them in a pretty good position to have a good year.
Yeah, we're hypothetically going to compete in each one of these games. I like that the first four games are all at home. It's kind of weird that we have a bye week so early, but maybe that allows us to kind of, you know, use those first two games as a kind of a sounding board before we hit the rest of the season and kind of reassess before we have that Stanford game. But I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm excited to see what this looks like. It's just going to have a whole nother feel to it.
I think we're going to learn a lot about this team on September 7th when we play Georgia Tech, or
yes,
as Matt and I like to call them this past year, Georgia Techel and Mr. Hyde, because you really don't know which version of them you were going to get. If they're anything like that, we hope we catch them on an off day, but we'll learn a lot about the team real early, having what should be a competitive conference game in week two.
So. Yep, and we won't have to see Jordan Travis. Is he staying or no?
No, it's DJ now.
Oh, it is. Okay.
You know, that's the biggest hole in this podcast now, is that Matt was the one who could pronounce his last name.
Oh, yes.
former Clemson quarterback DJ. I'm not even going to attempt it, but we'll have to edit.
We're on first name terms now.
We'll have to edit in audio of Matt saying his name. So yeah, it's late January, and we already get to talk a little bit more about Syracuse football. We never really stopped talking about Syracuse football this year, and that's usually a good thing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And just to kind of pick up where we left off last time, we kind of ran down some recruiting updates. The big one in the meantime has been Isaiah Hastings, 4-star defensive lineman from Alabama, 6'4", 290 pounds. Should help the pass rush make up for some of the players that we lost. And, you know, this defensive unit is going to be retooled with a bunch of large SEC guys. So now that's two transfers from Alabama total that we'll be playing on this defensive line next year, to go along with Fadil Diggs. And it's going to be a, It's going to be an exciting year, one way or another. I mean, I'm sitting here dreaming about my season tickets. Glad I still have those, and I think it's going to be interesting. But
you're not one of the 8,000 who's getting nixed with the dome consolidation.
No, we have to pick.
My understanding is they're revamping like the season ticket stuff, so you have to like reapply.
We have to pick new seats.
You have to pick new seats. And
you are given priority based on your donor status, so we'll be obviously near the bottom. So
that's interesting. Okay.
Speaking of the dome renovations, it is interesting that in a time where Syracuse is putting all this effort and money into the football program, that there's going to be a lot of excitement. People want to go, and now you're saying there's going to be like 10,000 fewer seats for football games. I think the new capacity is going to be roughly 38,000.
What I saw was 42, but 42? I just saw it in passing. I mean, what I like about that is that the student section, I think from what I saw, is going to expand, a marginal amount, which is good. I mean,
and move. They're being
not that moved. We've needed it the last few years.
They're being moved to the far end zone, the orange end zone.
Yeah.
And yeah, they're going to be expanded. So, and then I think they're going to put the band out over there too. So yeah, it's going to be very different layout. Hopefully it creates a more intimate setting. We're going to see fewer empty seats, and
maybe the acoustics will be better over there.
Yeah, and they still didn't make the damn seat backs orange, so that when there are empty seats, you can't tell because everyone's wearing orange. They're apparently making the seat backs blue for the most part. They didn't read the suggestion box this year.
Well, hopefully it doesn't matter, because I don't know. I think at least out of the gate, like we don't have, like, I think of, here in Washington, right? The Nationals, they just don't have a lot of a following. They don't have a loyal following when they're bad. This past season, when they were absolute garbage, most games that I went to were filled with the opposing fans more so than the hometown fans, right? Syracuse does not have that problem. Nobody wants to go to Syracuse. It's cold, it's frigid. But the local faithful want to be there at every game. Like, you see it in basketball, like even over the years as Boeheim has kind of, lost his some of his more impressive tournament streaks and winning seasons. And as we've sort of been on the decline, people still show up. They want to be there. So, I mean, I think that the potential is there for us to, go to homecoming and not be embarrassed by the lack of not just people in butts and seats, but like when the student section is empty, like that just bums me out big time. So I'm hoping this new era kind of motivates folks to really, get in there and energize the dome, because when it's packed, that is a great place to watch a game. It's electric. Like you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Syracuse has a lot of fair weather fans in their fan base. But the thing with Syracuse is that it could be 20 degrees and snowing, and that's still fair weather. So it doesn't take doesn't take much to get Syracuse fans to show up. They will bail if things are bleak, and they will shamelessly bail. They'll bail at halftime, and they'll stop coming for a few weeks. But with what's going on right now, you have to think the excitement's going to be there. And unless the team comes out and lays an egg right off the bat, the fans are going to show up for this new era of Syracuse football, and they're going to be excited. So yeah, I mean, the place gets loud. You only need about 35, 40,000 people who are engaged in the game for that place to get loud. So there's still plenty of seats. We got to fill them up, though. We have to make them regret taking any seats out of that place and fill it up week in, week out.
Right. To sum it up, though, I think the downsizing of seats is not necessarily a bad thing as I see it. Just because, when was the last time we sold out a football game? With 2019 for Clemson? I think that's the one.
Yeah, I think it's truly happened. I know for a fact that game. And then in 2009... was it Minnesota, the first game of the year? I believe that was a sellout, or pretty darn close to a sellout. Greg Paulus's first game.
I do. I was a freshman that we were both freshmen that year, and I remember the chancellor gave out free tickets to all
the they slid them under the dorm room doors. They just walked around the dorm, sliding the tickets under. Please. And that was to come out and support a new era with the first game of a new coach. So let's do that again. Let's fill it up. Kevin, any other thoughts on football? Any fleeting thoughts regarding the upcoming football schedule?
Nope. I mean, do we want to touch? Maybe at the end we can hit on Jim Harbaugh. I always get the Harbaughs mixed up.
Yeah.
And talk about his new prospects because he's no longer a college coach.
We're talking about football. We're talking about football. Why don't you go ahead and tell us the deal with Jim Harbaugh?
So yeah, Harbaugh is I just saw this come through, you know, an hour ago, is going to return to the NFL as head coach of the Los Angeles Chargers. I guess this guy can go do whatever he wants, but you'd think he'd want to, at least for more than 5 minutes, be, you know, Michigan royalty, having just won their first championship in 25 years. You'd think the guy would want to hang around and wait for the statue to be built of him. But I mean, some people just have that drive and they want to coach at the highest level. You know, you saw it with Nick Saban, right? The guy tried out the NFL and it didn't work, didn't fit, and he never went back. Some coaches just, and then you see on the opposite side, right? Like Pete Carroll, decided to really, you know, lean in on being a professional coach in the NFL, and it worked for him. But it's not for everybody. And I guess, you know, I mean, he's entering a pretty good situation. My understanding is that the Chargers had some problems on defense this year. Injuries and Herbert with the broken finger, Keenan Allen with a Keenan Allen injury. Mike Williams was out for the whole year pretty much once again. And then Austin Eckler was just not really the same player, but, you know, he must be seeing all that talent and thinking that he's the guy to kind of right the ship. And, you know, that because that team with that amount of talent, you had a couple more good years out of Eckler and Allen and Williams and Herbert's just getting started. Like you've got yourself a really strong contender right there. So we'll see. I wish him the best. You know, his brother's a little bit less of a hothead. I wish him the best, you know, in the AFC championship game coming up, but you know, I just thought it was a really interesting decision to win a championship and then
he's bored. Go
and jump he into another it. Fire.
He did it. There's nothing left to do. He's got to move on. Some guys just are not permanent college coaches, and it is a little odd because like you said, he could have stayed at Michigan and just been, you know, the Nick Saban there. To a lesser extent, success-wise, but he could have just been the guy with the longest leash and just run the program, been in charge, just been the godfather of Michigan football. But I think, you know, rumors of his return to the NFL have cropped up every couple of years for a while now. So I kind of get the impression he's always had one eye on the NFL. And now that he accomplished the ultimate goal at his current level, he figured, why not now? I did it. It's done. I accomplished the goal. Now it's hop back. And a lot of times, yeah, you can look at a situation where a guy moves to the NFL and you're like, oh, that's a mistake. Like, what did LSU fans think when Nick Saban took the Miami Dolphins job? It was questionable to begin with whether he could coach at the NFL level. Some guys,
they didn't care though. They would walk on glass for that guy. They would walk on fire and through a tornado.
And what was the situation when he decided to jump to the NFL? He won the championship and he went on to the next level. And obviously,
well, I mean, he won the championship and then he had a mediocre season and then he went to the next level. But you
know. Okay, so a little different. He's like, oh, maybe I can't just keep winning over and over again here. Let's go.
This Harbaugh though, he strikes me kind of like as a John Gruden, where he was in the NFL, he got out of it for a long time. You know, he was in the Super Bowl 10 years ago, 12 years ago, right? And, you know, Coach Colin Kaepernick, like, just had quite the run but never got the ring. And for whatever reason, in San Francisco, you know,
it fell apart. Things kind of fell apart.
I'm just trying to remember what happened. I mean, this is like long before the Christian McCaffrey era. But like, I don't know. You took kind of a Super Bowl contending team, and you know, he didn't get that ring. So I think kind of like Gruden, right? But I think with Gruden, it was more a franchise thing. He wanted to go be with the Raiders.
They also offered him an insane amount of money to come back.
Right. And yeah, and that we know how that worked out.
Yeah, Harbaugh's hoping his return goes better than that. But there's a lot of college coaches who, you know, you can kind of tell they just aren't cut out for the NFL. Like Nick Saban learned the hard way. You can't run an NFL team like you can run a college team. You can't boss NFL football players around and be Mr. Bad Guy coach like you can in college. Because the NFL, the players say, I make more money than you. I have more power than you. I don't have to listen to you. And that style just doesn't work. But like you alluded to, Jim Harbaugh's already had success in the NFL. He's already coached in a Super Bowl. So, you know, I have a feeling that it could work out there. He has a lot of solid pieces to work with. He's coming into a team that, I don't know what happened to Austin Eckler, but if he's anything close to what he's been, and you still have Keenan Allen and Mike Williams, like you said, if he's healthy, you have skill players and you have a quarterback. And those are the most important things. You need to have a quarterback to compete. So the rest they can figure out. But I can see what he sees in that roster. He's not coming into a dumpster fire situation.
And while we're on NFL, do you want to make quick picks for this weekend?
Quick picks? How quick of a pick? Let's see. Give me...
Who's going to win the AFC? Who's going to win the NFC?
Give me the Ravens and give me San Francisco.
Oh, man. Well, I was going to go Lions Chiefs. Here we go. Freaking Detroit Lions. I don't know if it's going to happen, but Dan Campbell's got something going on up there, and I want to see it through. I don't know if they'll win it, but something feels like Detroit's, you know, Jared Goff is ready to kind of come out of his shell after 10 years in the NFL or however, 8 years in the NFL. Prove all the naysayers who thought Carson Wentz was the better pick. Because I remember back in 2016 when they were drafted and it was Goff and Wentz, like, you know, me and Joe being Eagles and Rams fans, had the first two picks, and the consensus was, you know, Wentz is going to be better right off the bat, but Goff is going to be the better long-term, you know, asset. And I mean, some weird things have happened with both of them.
The Rams got them both anyway.
It's a very interesting development, but Goff is still at it, playing at a really high level. And Detroit's just fun this year, man. Like Jahmyr Gibbs, like, oh my God, he's electric, and somehow David Montgomery's found it, you know, a little extra gas in the tank. And I don't know. I think I'm just sort of a closet Dan Campbell fan just because, like, the way he coaches, just it's just a really fun time up there in Detroit. So I don't know. Maybe it's my heart speaking here, but, you know, I don't have any stake in the game because Philadelphia completely screwed the pooch, you know, as should have been the case. And now they're cleaning house, and you know, the fallout has been real. I want to see. I wanted to see Detroit Buffalo. That would have been super fun. Right. But let's do Detroit, and you know, it's got to be Kansas City. Yeah. The Ravens are a great team, but it just seems like Kansas City is destined for another one, another opportunity at the ring, and you know. I wish I could pick against them, but the way they're playing right now, I mean, it's just both sides of the ball. They're probably the most complete team, like, and well-rounded team right now besides San Francisco. But something just tells me Detroit's going to pull it out. We'll see.
Something to watch for with Detroit: former Syracuse defensive back Afitu Melifonwu is becoming a big part of that defense out there. I think he had 1.5 sacks in the last game. And with the regular season and postseason combined, he has like 4 sacks and a couple interceptions this year. So he's really come on and been a big part of that defense, and he's blossoming into a star. So it'll be fun to watch him continue to perform in the postseason. I've no ill will towards Jared Goff as a Rams fan. I'm a big fan of Jared Goff, and this is the best football he's ever played. First time he played in the Super Bowl, he was kind of a system guy who was just trying to play his role and facilitate for Todd Gurley, and that didn't end so well. And to see him go somewhere else and have success is good to see. So I could totally see Detroit pulling it out. And obviously Kansas City is going to be the favorite, but I would like to see Lamar Jackson take over a playoff game and just go off. So we'll see. I like that we picked opposite games. We'll get to come back here and see who was right, or we'll both be wrong.
It wasn't even on purpose.
Yeah. We did not plan that ahead.
And if we did, it would have been pretty lame.
Moving on to the topic of the season, Syracuse basketball. We missed a few games since we last talked. Some good, some not good, some not even worth mentioning. But there was a 69-59 win over Boston College, led by Chris Bell and Malik Brown with 20 and 19 points, respectively. We followed that up with a game against UNC that was canceled due to the weather or something. Syracuse lost 103-67 in Chapel Hill, and there's not a whole lot to say. In this case, the score really does say it all. But to their credit, the team was able to bounce back with a 69-58 win over Pittsburgh. J.J. Starling and Judah Mintz led them with 17 and 14 points, respectively. And I'm sure nobody missed this, but that was followed up with a win at home against Miami, 72-69, on a buzzer-beating three-pointer by Quiddia Copeland.
Terrible. A terrible, terrible,
terrible play. We can dive into that in a minute.
Why do you need to take a three there? But, I mean, it was amazing.
Well, okay. We'll talk about it now since we've already opened the can. I'm okay with him taking the shot because Judah dribbled the offense into that position. He waited till there were 8 seconds left in the clock. Then he drove headfirst directly into three defenders. And then just kind of stood there and said, well, I guess this isn't going to work, and just threw the ball across the court. Credit to him for realizing his wrongdoing and looking up, because the Judah we've seen in the past would have just kept his head down and flung that ball up towards the rim, hoping he got fouled. And I'm guessing that's more or less what the play was. Judah drives, and you hope he gets fouled. But he realized there was nowhere to go. He brought his head up. He found his teammate. Copeland was open. I mean, if he had been inside the three-point arc, there's a good chance a defender finds him before he's able to get the shot off, and it's a more contested shot. Obviously, we didn't need the three-pointer, and obviously he's a bad three-point shooter. But he was there. He was open. He set his feet, and it was good.
Yeah, I'd love to take a clip of that last play where Copeland drained the three and mail it to Trevor Cooney with a little note on it that says, "This is what you should have done in 2013 when you got stuffed by the backboard as time expired in the Final Four. You pass it out and you take a three-pointer down by 3 points." In this case, it was reversed, right? We were only down by two. We didn't need a three-pointer. So I figured what you said. I figured Judah was just going to try to take one in and get fouled maybe. Because then you kind of have two bites of the apple, right? You can maybe make the shot, maybe get an end one, but most likely just get the two shots for the foul. And that's not what he did, though. It seemed almost like Copeland caught it and then checked to like make sure he was behind the arc, which I'm just like, why do we care? It's we need 2 points. That's it. But I mean, you know, to his credit, he drained it. And I don't know, I've become a pretty big Cuttier Copeland fan in the last couple of weeks. He's been impressive, and just seems like he's a winner, right? He's really driven in all the right ways, and I like watching him. He's fun to watch. You know, this whole team is fun to watch. You know, I find it hard to get into basketball until about, you know, the holidays and the new year. And now I'm fully into it. And it's been fun kind of getting back into the swing of things. But yeah, that was a questionable play, but you know, whatever, 3 points.
It worked. You know, it's an improvement because last year, 100% that ball does not get kicked out. Judah just throws something up and we lose the game.
He had 8 assists in that game, which I think was the season high for him.
In the Miami game?
Yeah, I think he had
13 assists.
Oh, 13. Okay, I must be.
Judah's line was 10 points, 8 rebounds, and 13 assists, which is a phenomenal game for him. I would rather take that than what we saw against Florida State, which unfortunately we'll talk about in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But it was good. You know, I think it was an improvement because we've seen Judah put his head down and not be more aware of what's going on. So at least he had the wherewithal to realize it wasn't going to work and find somebody else. Sure, it didn't need to be a 3, but hey, it worked.
Doing it for the fans.
We needed something like that. And I was hoping that would have been more of a spur for the team to kind of hit some momentum and keep going. But what stood out to me in that game, you know, you led by JJ Starling, who had I don't know where this came from, 6 of 10 from 3. And, you know, his jump shot has really, really come around. It's not like his form is still horrible and he's just getting lucky. He has had noticeable improvement in his jumper, in his form. So it's not just a coincidence that more of his shots are falling. He's had a noticeable improvement. And that goes along with Chris Bell, who hit 4 out of 10, which, you know, it's 40%. And that's a good game for him. If he can knock down 4 or 5 threes, that's always going to really be a big thing for us. And then, like we said, Judah with 10, 8, and 13 almost got the triple-double. I'd take that Judah any day, facilitating like that for his teammates, finding open guys, because this team isn't going to go anywhere if someone besides Judah doesn't score. So that kind of brings us to the Florida State game from last night. Syracuse lost 85-69. Judah had 28 points and 3 assists and not much else from anyone or anything. We were in it right up until about the 8-minute mark or so, and then Florida State put their foot on the gas and ran away with it. They wore us down. They had a great game plan. I don't know about you, but this is one of the first games where I know we played poorly, we shot poorly, we missed a lot of free throws.
Speaking of Trevor Cooney, you can't win a game when you shoot 7% from
you
three.
And that's on a single
1 for 14
three-pointer. You know, this team clearly is going to go as far as its three-point shooting will take it, because it's when it can knock down some shots from distance, it's pretty good at other things. If you can hit threes, the spacing's better. That allows Judah and JJ to do their thing, getting to the rim easier, and it allows the offense to have a little more flow. And when that doesn't happen, when there isn't anyone hitting threes but continuing to take threes, that's when you have the offense is all congested, there's no movement, there's no flow, and everything just kind of falls apart, there's no rebounding. But when we're hitting threes, it almost feels like not only is the offense in a better flow, but guys are also, because maybe this has to do with the floor spacing, but guys are in a better position to get some offensive rebounds, and you give yourself second chances. You get some easy points for yourself, especially Malik Brown, who, you know, has been a big game changer for this team. But I found the Florida State game to be very disheartening because I saw some momentum building with this team, and coming off that 13 assist game, and then we see an old Judah game where he puts up 28 points by getting fouled a lot and forcing himself to the basket, but he didn't really create for anyone else, and no one else was really helping him, and all of our shooters went cold. So I'm not sure which Syracuse basketball team we're going to see going forward. If Starling has truly found his jump shot and he's going to contribute in that regard, if Chris Bell is finding some consistency with his jump shot, then I feel like this could be a decent team that could make the tournament and win a game or two. But if they're going to still be this team that can take 14 threes and hit one of them, then I don't see this team going very far at all. So, Kevin, where are you at with all this?
Losing. I don't know if we talked about this previously. I don't know where his injury was, but Naheem McLeod being out for the year is a bummer, because not that he was lighting it up or anything, but it's just good to have a Chukwu, you know, type, like not necessarily Chukwu himself, but like someone to put in there that's true five. I mean, Brown is doing the best he can, but he just I feel like we have this conversation every year about size, and we're playing a power forward that is sort of forced into playing that five role. I mean, we have to do all kinds of things to get creative because we just don't have a true center. You know, he's the putbacks are mind-blowing, right? The rebounding is fantastic coming from where he is, but the guy just doesn't have quite the size. He's outmatched in almost every game. And I mean, it kind of shows. And so what I'm afraid of is that we revert to the old, you know, Boeheim era of, okay, well, we can't rebound, so let's just chuck up threes and hope that a few of them go in and we're in it at the end of the game. So if we're relying on that and we're going to shooting 7% from three is just sort of like, I don't know, I even know how we were in that game. But I mean, this team has a lot of, it's a lot more dynamic than that. So when the three ball is not there, I just don't want to see us forcing it. Like, I still want to see us going inside, taking good jump shots, and obviously having Judah do what he does best, which, like, the guy is just electric, man. It's fun to watch him. So I don't know. I mean, we haven't really found our identity yet. I think we're still waiting to get that, you know, Red Autry stamp on this team, and we'll see where that goes. But so right now on January 24th, it really does feel like we're going to be one of those bubble teams like the Syracuse of old, you know, which is fun, but, you know, it'd be great to not be a bubble team for once. So if we can win a couple of these games, you know, and get above that hump. But I think the Miami game was huge. I noticed near the end, I think I said to Cairo during that game, we had identical record. I think at the time we were 12-5, 3-3 in conference with Miami. And I'm like, these are the teams that we need to beat in order to even get to that bubble stage. And, you know, thankfully that worked out. Florida State didn't. So we're kind of right back where we started. Because I think Florida State is kind of like middling, you know, in the conference as well.
Florida State's in second place in the conference. Their overall record, were missing one of their better players. Primo Spears didn't play in their first like eight games. And so their non-conference, right, they didn't do so hot, but they've been electric in conference play. So they're actually in second place behind North Carolina in conference play.
Well, like we said to start the year, we needed to be north of 500 in conference, and right, we're right back to 500 now, if I'm not mistaken.
So I'll disagree with you a little bit on Malik Brown in that, obviously, yeah, he's playing out of position, but I think he's fared better than 7'4" and Nyheim McLeod would have in just about every one of these games. Maybe North Carolina, we could have used his size a little bit.
Well, yeah, and the fouls too. You gotta have somebody to go in there and Sidibe eat fouls.
I agree 100%. Clearly, Munir Hema's not healthy, and Peter Carey's not ready. And I would prefer to have Nyheim McLeod, but if Nyheim McLeod were healthy, I think Malik Brown should still be the starting five on this team and play a bulk of the minutes. And unless there's a matchup that requires Nyheim McLeod to be out there, I love what Malik Brown's been giving us so far. I keep coming back to the Boston College game, which we won largely in part because Malik Brown was able to hold Quentin Post, one of the best offensive big men in the conference, scoreless. And Quentin Post is a 7-footer, a skilled offensive big man, and Malik Brown was able to shut him down, and his rebounding has been great. His pick and roll game has been good. We don't really have much of one without him. And he's undersized, but I haven't really felt like that's been even a top three reason we've lost any of these games that we've lost is anything to do with being outmatched down low. FSU had a, you know, good size overall and were crazy athletic, but didn't really have anyone that was dominating Malik Brown physically. This was just a team collapse. And what I will say, I was left feeling like the Florida State game is the first game that I've really come away feeling like, wow, Red really got outcoached in that one. And that felt like a game where we really got outcoached by Leonard Hamilton. Florida State came out with a game plan. They executed it. And we really didn't have much of one. Sure, we could have won the game if we shot better from three and made a few more free throws, but we didn't really have much of a game plan to fall back on. Meanwhile, Florida State had one, they executed it, and And, you know, that's not surprising coming from Leonard Hamilton, who's one of the best coaches in the conference. But you go online after a game like that, and you start seeing like, oh, red's not the answer. We need to move on. It's like, give the guy a chance. Like, sure, there's going to be games like this. These are going to happen. But there are growing pains with a new coach and trying to overhaul the program. And you really feel like red doesn't quite have the talent that he needs to turn this thing around. And obviously he's begun to turn around. To me, the team is way more watchable, way more fun, more successful than the last few years. And I'm not going to argue against that, but I can't wait for the next batch of recruits coming in next year to really have an influx of talent on this team. Cause you have JJ, you have Judah, you have Malik. You like what Copeland can give you, but Copeland's still a volatile player. He's up, he's down. We're praising him because he's been playing well. He didn't have a good game against Miami, and he didn't have a good game against Florida State. So he's still very up and down. So if he finds some consistency in his game and can just rein it in a little bit and not be so out of control at times, then he's going to be a really good player. But this roster needs more talent. We have some auxiliary pieces that are being asked to play large roles that they shouldn't be asked to play. Justin Taylor's not a starting ACC caliber player right now. He's not even really playing like an ACC caliber player at all. He's supposed to be a 3-point shooter and a rebounder, and he's rebounding. He's not hitting any shots. He's essentially a zero on offense, and that's been a drain on the team. You have Benny Williams, supposed to be a borderline 5-star talent, who just in year three.
He's getting way too many minutes.
Yeah, you know, I part of me wants him to get more minutes because I want him to find what he had at the end of last year, where he really was starting to become the player that he was supposed to be. He was hitting threes. He was rebounding. He had a mid-range game. He was a good player. And we need Benny Williams to be a good player for this team to go anywhere. And I don't know what the deal is. I don't know what was happening with him earlier in the year with the suspensions, but at the end of last year, Benny Williams was a good starting player. And now sometimes he's a liability out there and he's almost a non-factor on offense. That's a little disheartening to see. I had high hopes for him coming into the year. And I agree, sometimes it's tough when he's out there, but I don't know how you're going to get him any better without letting him play through some of it.
Yeah.
Would you rather have him out there?
He just hasn't panned out.
Would you rather have him out there than Justin Taylor? Because right now, for me, I would say yes.
Yeah, I mean, if Justin Taylor's not draining a three, then he's just not really worth his
weight. When's the last time you watched a Syracuse basketball game and said to yourself, wow, Justin Taylor really shot it well today?
That's a good point. I think last season, probably.
Coming into the Florida State game, I kind of felt this is one you need to win to make the tournament. And I think I still feel that way a little bit, but as I reflect on it more, I'm not sure it's a deal breaker, and I think there's still a path. It's big that we won that Miami game, but
well,
Florida State's a quad three loss right now. And we anticipate that Florida State will continue to play well in conference play and that will probably move up to only a quad two loss. But right now, it's a quad three loss, which is a pretty big blemish.
But a couple of things happened, though, after that Miami game is our win against Pittsburgh became a Q1. Our win against Miami is a Q1.
It is not. I think Miami is not nearly as high in the net rankings as I thought they were.
We had another game to turn into a Q1 as well. So I think we have three Q1 wins now.
And it's the Pittsburgh game. The Oregon game is very close and probably end up one. Currently it is not.
No, I think Oregon got reclassified.
Oregon moved up to 51. They need to be 50 for it to be a quad one win on a neutral court. And Miami's nowhere near. They would need to be top 30 in the net for the home game against them to be a quad one win. So that probably isn't happening either. So right now you're looking at two likely quad one wins when the season's over. And now we're hoping that Florida State plays well in conference play. And that moves up from being a quad three loss. Because quad three loss hurts right now. It's our only one. Previously, we were undefeated in quads 2 through 4.
Yikes. Well, yeah, it looks like our last few Q1 opportunities, Wake Forest, UNC, Clemson. So, you know, we'll see what we can do with that.
You know what you can do if you really want to make the NCAA tournament this year? Go beat North Carolina in the Dome. You make up for the embarrassment in Chapel Hill a couple weeks ago, and you give yourself a quad one win against the top team. Now, do I think this team is equipped to be able to pull that off? I don't. It's such a bad matchup for us every year, and especially this team kind of gets exposed against a team like that. And like I said last week, this team on paper has been a team that wins the games they're supposed to win and then gets absolutely dismantled by anybody better. And we haven't seen anything but that. And now you have, you know, Florida State on paper was more or less pretty comparable. They were kind of a peer. They had a worse overall record. They were hot in conference play. And it took till the end of the second half, but in the end, they tore us apart. So I'm not really sure. Obviously, there's still a path. If you can bounce back from this, like you bounced back from the North Carolina loss, then there's still a path.
Oh, I forgot about this. So we beat Pittsburgh twice, and one of them is a Q2 win because it was at home. The one on the road was a Q1 win because they're right there on that border.
So that leads me to, I mean,
let's root for Pittsburgh for the rest of the year, you know, so that those can both be classified.
Pittsburgh will never play their way into the home game being a quad one win. To be a quad one win, you have to be top 30 in the net ranking. Pittsburgh, and then to be a road win that's quad one, the opponent has to be top 75. So, I see. Pittsburgh would have to do a lot to get into that top 30, which I don't see happening. But I'm not sure. I'm guessing maybe the Clemson game will probably be a quad one opportunity, if I had to guess.
Yeah. Yeah, this is that. This says that Clemson's Q1 because it's on the road.
So that's
they're ranked 32 right now. That's the
one I'm looking at to be potentially a quad one opportunity.
Last game of the year, March 5th. That's going to
be a big one. You might need that one and then a couple games in the ACC tournament. Like I said, or you pull off a miracle and you go beat North Carolina.
Yep. Or Wake Forest.
I kind of think you have to win that one. Yeah. But yeah, if you don't beat North Carolina, which, you know, who are we kidding? It's very unlikely. I think you can only lose another game or two besides that one to even have a chance. I don't think there's a path.
Or do something.
I don't think there's a path out there right now where we're not a bubble team. I don't think they could do anything and say, okay, we're out short of winning out. I don't think there's anything they could do where it's like, okay, we're in.
Yeah. We'll see where that goes. We may need to do some damage in the conference tournament, which is always a fun time when you need to win those conference games and then you don't, or you win two games, but like, you know, we went into it being like, well, you need to win at least three, and then we win two.
Well, maybe that's like, well, we did really well.
And then Bubble Cityville.
Right. Well,
I don't enjoy this. Yeah. I don't enjoy this. I really miss the days that we were in school and perennial top five team. And, you know, I think there was one year we went 25-0 to start the season. Those days are over.
I think what we might see this year is going to be frustrating because it could very possibly have a team that is pretty fun to watch and pretty easy to root for. That's going to finish the year with a record that looks nice. I think we're going to look at the record and say, oh, they had a good year, and not make the tournament because it's going to be a record where there's really not a lot of meat on the bones. And it's what we've been seeing. You win the games that are against peers or less, and then you get dismantled by everybody else. And that doesn't get you into the tournament. This team could only lose 7 or 8 games and not make the tournament. And we haven't really seen that before. But there's really no quality wins to this point to point to kind of build a resume on. I mean, coming up next, you know, we have NC State in the Dome on Saturday. That's another big one. I think you have to win that game going forward to have a chance.
Yep. And I mean, when in the past, though, have we had really no very bad losses?
Right.
I mean, we don't have any Q4 losses. We have the one Q3 loss against Florida
State. The last few years of Beheim, we've
definitely
had bad.
We always had that one. Losses. We always had Middle Tennessee or, you know, Holy Cross or, you know, something where we lost a stupid game early because we just couldn't be bothered. It doesn't feel like that this year. I think we're a more disciplined team. But, you know, just as soon as I start thinking that, then, I mean, we had some issues at the free throw line on, I guess it was on Sunday against Florida State that were left to be desired. I don't know what the stats were, but it just seemed like we were a little bit lackluster behind the free throw line, which was the perennial staple of the Boeheim era, as he never in 45 years gave two hoots about free throws, right, which, you know, probably cost us dozens of wins over the years, if not hundreds.
Well, there's a prime opportunity standing in front of us. I'm not sure where NC State falls in the net rankings currently, probably not high enough for this to be a quad one opportunity at home, but they're 13-5, 5-2 in conference.
This says they are okay. Q3.
So they are about to lose to Virginia right now. That game's about to wrap up. So you can't lose this game. You have to win. And I think, you know, I'm optimistic Syracuse will bounce back and will be able to win this game against North Carolina. So I'm going to take – or North Carolina State. So I'm going to take Syracuse to win this one 72-67. I think we're going to see the defense – really come back strong.
And I'll go you know, we win this one 60 to
oh, that's gonna 52. Be a horrible game. Why would you say that? That's not gonna be fun at all.
We've been playing slow lately.
No, we've been running. I mean, score 60,
I think we only scored like 30 points in the first half a couple of weeks ago.
It's not because we're playing slow, it's because we're missing all of our shots, but we've still been playing fast. We've just been missing a lot of shots.
Yeah, well.
I hope you're wrong. I mean, I hope you're right that we win, but I hope you're wrong about the score. I don't know if I want to watch that game.
Well, we'll see. Someone's got to spice it up, you know.
On the horizon, we have lacrosse season starting up. So we'll see if we can wrangle Colin out of retirement to come talk some Syracuse lacrosse before the first game of the year next Saturday. So we'll do a lacrosse preview next week when we come back. So I believe that is all that we have for this week. If you have the 1990 NCAA lacrosse trophy, let us know. We just want to make sure that it's safe.
No, let Matt know.
Send him a carrier pigeon. Really, Matt is the one who needs to know. But if you let us know, we'll let him know. But Matt, if you're out there, if you're listening, we miss you. We need you. Please come back.
Hey, we managed to fill 56 minutes. Yeah, look at that. That's not bad.
All right. Well,
next time we'll just talk slower.
For Kevin O'Keefe, I'm Joe Schell. We hope to be back next week.